Chapter 1. Naval Inheritance. When Andrew Jackson concluded his two terms as President of the United States in 1837, his farewell address was more than a simple reflection on his tenure and the accomplishments he hoped would define his legacy. His farewell address was also a recognition of maritime circumstances, opportunities for increased activity, and vision that he had not fully recognized when he was first elected. It represented robust, mature insight about the role of the Navy in the country's economic development and defense. It demonstrated a more attentive and mature reflection of the world and the Navy, and was more clearly in line with the navalists, those who believed that a peacetime Navy served as a permanent deterrent to aggression and focused on national image, prestige, diplomatic clout, and national greatness. Jackson's farewell address includes a comparatively lengthy treatise on the Navy's purpose and roles. In 1836, with peace reigning and revenue overflowing, he believed that the United States could, year after year, add to the Navy's strength without burdening the people. The Monroe Doctrine of 1823, with its goal of closing the Western Hemisphere to further European colonization, was unenforceable given the relatively small size of the American Navy compared to its European counterparts. That task fell to the British Royal Navy, acting on Foreign Secretary George Canning's policies, which had a shared goal to minimize other European involvement in the Western Hemisphere. The philosophical evolution of Jackson's views occurred in tandem with the emergence of naval self-identity and culture that became the basis of American naval power. In order to become a global maritime power by the end of the 19th century and a superpower in the 20th century, the United States required more than simply a large fleet. The Navy needed a culture that recognized and embraced modern technology and education. It needed organized specialists who improved the lives of sailors and officers through the standards of physical health, as well as some who tended to their spiritual strength. It needed a rising corps of officers and like-minded, influential civilians who had the capacity for self-reflection, vision, and advocacy. Changing global and domestic circumstances, as well as an enhanced recognition of the Navy's role in advancing American commerce, intervention, and deterrence, resulted in naval visionaries advocating a non-parochial internationalist view. This chapter examines the international, domestic, and naval forces that contributed to the state of the Navy by 1828. It also discusses the personal leadership factors, namely the integral and respective career developments of John Quincy Adams and Andrew Jackson, that affected the trajectory of the Navy. An Army general, Jackson had little experience with the Navy outside of the Battle of New Orleans. Years of military action during the War of 1812 and the Seminole War, and years of service as a politician and a judge, shaped Jackson. Upon his inauguration in March 1829, Jackson inherited a Navy only 3 decades old. Yet that Navy was culturally, operationally, and strategically quite different from his more familiar Army. It also lacked experience, as unlike the Army, the Navy had not seen military action in more than a decade, other than engagements against pirates in the West Indies. Philosophical influence on the Republic and the Navy. By the start of the 1830s, the United States had established its egalitarian credentials philosophically, but not in practice as witnessed with slavery and those who had no voting rights. No novelty in the United States struck me more vividly during my stay there than the equality of conditions. Alexis de Tocqueville remarked in his magisterial 1835 work, Democracy in America. Benjamin Franklin and others had proven that American wealth and position could be earned rather than inherited, at least not in the landed aristocratic senses of European states. Certainly, comparatively small merchant houses of the North and the plantations of the South dotted the economic landscape, but equality of conditions meant that practically any free man willing to work or exploit an idea could benefit from a free and capitalistic society. This ability to improve one's social and economic status, to become the equal of those who had inherited land wealth, was a unique feature of the United States, one that contemporaries in Europe could never hope to achieve. The United States, as Tocqueville noted, was eminently democratic. Such a democratic mentality imbued its citizens in the Navy with a sense of empowerment. This mentality was also reflected in the young nation's militia, which voted for its military leaders rather than have them appointed. Jackson, elected in the 1790s, was one such leader. Jacksonian America was, in many ways, the culmination of the Democratic Republic first conceptualized by Greek philosophers, though slavery and lack of women's rights darkened the ideal. The concepts of individual freedom and the right to challenge authority had evolved from documents such as the Magna Carta through the Mayflower Compact and English Bill of Rights. The U.S. concept of individual freedom and collective governance were derived from Plato, Augustine, Aquinas, Montesquieu, Rousseau, and perhaps most importantly, Hobbes and Locke. In 1829, most Americans, excluding the founders, would not know the names of these intellectuals, but they would have been familiar with their ideas, which were intensely debated in the Federalist and Anti-Federalist papers during the battle for ratification of the U.S. Constitution in 1787. American naval culture reflected national culture, but in some ways, it progressed more quickly and differently. The Navy was a microcosm of a country that had grown more comfortable in its democratic garb. America of the 1830s sought to move beyond the geographical boundaries set by the Atlantic Ocean and the Mississippi River. In expanding westward toward the Rocky Mountains, the United States took on the role of conqueror in some cases and constable in others. The Navy, on the other hand, better reflected the more commercial and enlightened side of the country's identity. But the young democratic government, whose powers resided largely with the states, experienced a change with the more heavy-handed Jackson, who was intent on expanding the power of the national government's executive branch. In response to more authoritarian leadership in the White House, the Navy developed its own unique culture, a culture that gave it an outward-facing, global focus. The Navy believed it had a destiny, and though it took decades to be realized, the concept was born in the age of Jackson. The Army represented a constabulary force Jackson would use against the American Indians, with whom he felt no obligation to adhere to treaties. Tocqueville foresaw that all the great wartime leaders who may arise in the major democratic nations will find it easier to conquer with the aid of their armies than to make their armies live at peace after conquest. The Navy, by contrast, served to protect commerce when able and to carry out minor punitive actions as needed. Unlike the Army, the Navy had neither the ability nor the intent to carry out expansive engagements during this period. It established no naval outposts other than agents whose purpose was to provide a conduit with the local governing authorities in foreign ports. It neither conquered nor occupied foreign lands, but its ships were involved in attacks on native islanders. Tocqueville devoted 5 chapters to the nature of armies, but only 1 sentence to the destiny of America's Navy. He certainly would have been familiar with the Navy during his extensive journeys along the coastline. His brevity on the subject suggests that he may have viewed the U.S. Navy as tasked primarily with protecting American commerce rather than as a potentially occupying, aggressive force like the Army. Beyond philosophical underpinnings, the Army and Navy differed in other ways. As one historian notes, the specific factors that will inevitably affect the formulation and execution of a grand strategy are easy to describe. Geographical position is perhaps the most obvious and important. The Army found itself constrained by the realities of American geography, while the Navy was unconstrained by the opportunities the oceans presented. With no ability to transport its troops overseas, the U.S. Army of the 1830s remained restricted to the North American continent by 4 controlling interests: British-controlled Canada to the north, Texas and Mexico to the southwest, Florida, where or Native American tribes, primarily Seminoles, remained a dominant force after Spain ceded the region of the United States in 1821 to the south, and the tribal lands that lay beyond Illinois and the Mississippi River to the west. Between 1830 and 1838, most U.S. Army forts were situated in these unorganized territories, serving as the nation's barrier between its own civilization and a swath of land it viewed as riddled with godless people. Posts quickly emerged in the Kansas Territory, such as Fort Leavenworth, 1827, and in the Oklahoma Territory, such as Fort Gibson and Fort Towson, both 1824, and Camp Washita, 1834. These posts served as conduits for the government-enforced Indian expulsion from Florida, Georgia, Tennessee, Alabama, and Mississippi that began in 1830. Army posts, by their nature, encroached upon and held land. As the military emerged as an agent of American nationalism, it did so in an egalitarian society that rejected privilege and preferred equality of condition and the unfettered pursuit of liberty. By contrast, during the same period, the U.S. Navy, which was served by the long-established yards in Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Washington, and Charleston, held no ground outside the states with the exception of Pensacola in the panhandle of Florida, which did not become a state until 1845. This presence in Pensacola was established to protect the reserves of live oak plantations in the Southwest, a key feature of U.S. warships since the designs of Joshua Humphreys in the 1790s. With neither the ability nor the need to hold territory, the Navy's experience was that of near-continuous duty on foreign stations. Foreign ports required and fostered cooperation among naval powers. They also served as havens for merchant ships. Militant action against established ports would have disrupted the flow of commerce, in direct opposition to the purpose for which the Navy existed in the first place. Such action also threatened the ability of naval ships to operate and remain on distant stations, reliant as they were on local food, water, and goods. Geography, in terms of times and distance, also favored the Army in terms of communication with the Secretary of War or the President. The Army could conduct few military operations or negotiations without direction from Washington because its senior officers were days or at most a few weeks away by horse. U.S. Navy ships operating in the Mediterranean, Pacific, or elsewhere were months from communication with Washington, which provided naval commanders greater latitude and responsibility in representing their country. The complexity of communication with ships and squadrons was, in fact, exponentially greater because they were not always tied to any one port, nor were their routes as predictable as those of Army troops marching on a predetermined path from one post to another. Communication with the Mediterranean was easier than other distant stations, since the Navy based its squadron at Port Mahon, Spain, through which all correspondence passed. With several ships in the squadron, at least one ship was always available for dispatches to the United States. In contrast, the Pacific Squadron, comprising only two ships, was forced to rely on passing merchant ships to exchange information or to take the seemingly drastic or practical step chosen by its Commodore, Charles Stewart, who used his personal funds to finance the construction of his own dispatch boats to keep in communication with Washington. Deployed naval squadrons were partly immune from the political machinations of Washington, as political fortunes rose and fell. The simple factor of distance from policymakers tempered debates about action or inaction. Squadron commodores were free to engage in more fruitful diplomatic relations with their counterparts or heads of state. Left alone to their deliberations, the squadron commodores demonstrated remarkable restraint in the absence of clear and near-continuous direction, though the impetuous actions of some individuals, such as Captain David Porter during the Fajardo Affair, 1824, and Captain John Downs in the attack of Kuala Batu, 1832, deviated from those of the more cautious commodores. This freedom with which many Navy commanders operated effectively came to a halt at the end of the Jacksonian era, when the introduction of the telegraph in the 1840s made communication much easier. The Navy's reliance on diplomacy resulted not only from geography, but also from simple necessity. Naval ships were more reliant on other nations to conduct operations than was the Army, which was largely self-reliant in North America. Companies of soldiers had wagon trains of supplies for ammunition, clothing, and food. Also, food and water were generally available throughout the areas in which the Army operated during the 1830s. Horses could graze during rest. Shelter in the form of tents was cheap to procure and easy to set up. By contrast, the Navy was encumbered with ships requiring constant attention and maintenance. A leaking hull threatened their survival, and masts and sails were their only means of propulsion and stability. The crew likewise required support and maintenance. The necessities of life, food, and water were always in finite supply on board a ship. When these stores were depleted, the crew had to rely on the closest port for replenishment. The availability of supplies depended on that port's willingness to do business with the U.S. Navy, and, of course, on the Navy's ability to pay for them. During the Jacksonian era, West Point graduated approximately 40 cadets annually, though not all of them went on to a career as an Army officer. Naval officers, by contrast, began serving and training on their first day in the Navy. Nearly all officers entered the service at the rank of midshipman, most of them only in their mid-teens. The midshipmen received a sparse education, with the chaplain on each ship responsible for conducting classes, while the remainder of their time was focused on learning the fundamentals of ship handling, navigation, and gunnery. Rare was the naval officer who entered as a lieutenant, although several Jacksonian-era captains had entered at this rank because they already possessed significant maritime experience. Commodore Charles Stewart, for example, who received a commission as a lieutenant at the age of 19 in 1798, had first gone to sea as a cabin boy on a merchant ship at the age of 12, and had risen through the ranks to command his own merchant ship out of Philadelphia before entering the Navy. Unlike the Army, the Navy did not produce politicians during the 19th century. Several presidents from Washington to Jackson served in the military, but exclusively in the Army. Presidential family members also served in the Army, such as Martin Van Buren's son, Abraham, who was aide-de-camp to Major General Macomb during Jackson's presidency. Both Washington and Jackson, for example, had achieved considerable victories at the end of their wars, the American Revolution and War of 1812, respectively. Americans failed to understand or significantly appreciate that the victories at Yorktown and New Orleans would not have been possible without naval support, achieved by the French in the case of the former. While one naval engagement could be romanticized, there were no civilian journalists on board warships to observe, interview, and report on the actual actions. Army officers had an advantage in politics because their actions were more immediately available to the media. The other and more likely reason was that the ranks of general and captain seemed far different in the public's mind. Generals commanded an army of the people and militias, whereas captains commanded only a ship. Generals led strategic campaigns and won wars. Captains largely engaged single-ship actions since, with the exception of the Battle of Lake Erie Squadron, engagements were rare due to the size of the Navy. This disparity was not lost on the Navy, which would rigorously debate the need for an admiral-level rank during this decade. Jackson's familiarity with the Army was therefore understandable. He was a product of that institution, and he had helped shape it in the first decades of the American Republic. On December 16, 1814, in declaring martial law in New Orleans, prior to the final battle of the War of 1812, he had challenged basic constitutional rights. During his presidency, Jackson surrounded himself with former Army officers. John Eaton, for example, served as his first Secretary of War. Jackson's secretary and close confidant, was his nephew, Andrew Jackson Donelson. Between 1821 and the Civil War, excluding the Mexican-American War, the size of the army ranged from 5,000 to 15,000 men, though Jackson authorized the creation of two new regiments, the 1st Dragoons in 1833 and the 2nd Dragoons in 1836. His actions suggested a need for the professionalization of the armed forces after the abrupt resignation of 47 army officers in 1835 and double that in 1836, as the Second Seminole War began. One of the era's greatest legislators and political adversary of Jackson, Henry Clay, heard from his own son, Henry Clay, Jr., a cadet in 1830, that the army in itself provides no attraction whatever, other than of a certain and independent support. Jackson, with little tolerance for those who eschewed military service, took a more imperial approach than his predecessors. His views carried over into the Van Buren administration as well. To stem the tide of officers leaving their service early, officers were held accountable and sent back to their units to complete their obligation. This was especially enforced with West Point graduates. Although the Army had been a significant part of his life and captivated his attention, especially with the Second Seminole War, he was not ignorant of what the Navy offered. Although one Jacksonian historian argued that Jackson had little understanding or use for the Navy, evidence suggests otherwise. Jackson was the product of the Army and a promoter of presidential power. The Navy was less familiar to him, but he understood that it had the capability for divergent missions. The Navy of 1829. The Navy Jackson inherited in March 1829 faced multiple challenges. Arguably, the Navy lacked a central, justifiable mission that would engender comprehensive support from both the public and Congress. This lack of support manifested itself in numerous ways. In 1829, the Navy found itself still in the early stages of global presence on distant stations. The duties and logistics complications associated with establishing new stations were compounded by a rudimentary industrial base, struggles for resources, disparate education, lack of available manpower, and stagnation in innovation. Prior appropriations supported construction of a new naval hospital, in addition to that at New Orleans, but there was as yet no system in place for the management of sick and disabled seamen. The Navy had also failed to respond to 1828 legislation providing for a better organization of the medical department. The law required a change in how assistant surgeons were admitted to the service in time and grade before being promoted to surgeon. Secretary of the Navy Samuel Southard reported to Congress that, despite its required measures, none had been put into place. Most of Southard's report consisted of concerns with pension funds from both former active duty naval personnel and privateer seamen. In most navies, even in the 21st century, the most significant cost is not platforms and weapons, but personnel, including their training, food, medical care, and other benefits such as retirement. As it had for most of the 1820s, discussion continued in Congress and in the Navy on the merits of an exploring expedition to the Pacific and South Sea to survey coasts, inlands, and reefs. In subsequent reports to Congress, but prior to Jackson's inauguration in March, the Secretary of the Navy provided amplifying information on the costs associated with an expedition. Southard and others recognized the demonstrable deficiency of American nautical charts. With an estimated 200 or more islands and reefs and shoals that did not appear on any chart, such an expedition was necessary to predict the lives and seafaring property of American whalers in the region. Nevertheless, it would be nearly another decade before the multi-ship expedition would get underway. The character of officers and sailors suggested that naval discipline had been generally commendable in 1828, but infractions nonetheless required responses. Some suggested a criminal code, a naval school, and a revised body of naval rules and regulations. All three potential remedies had been suggested to Congress via separate reports. Conspicuously absent from Southard's 1828 report to Congress was significant mention of global naval operations, despite squadrons operating in the West Indies, Pacific, Mediterranean, and elsewhere. Southard had only one sentence on piracy operations by the Mediterranean squadron. Otherwise, an appendix noted only a list of vessels and their locations. Two-thirds of the Navy, 23 ships, were deployed that year, including one 74-gun ship of the line. Southard estimated that the Navy's 1829 budget would be more than $3.6 million. The total budget for the U.S. government that year was $17 million. For a young republic with few resources, devoting 20% of its budget was out of proportion to its limited ability. Army and Navy expenditures comprised more than half of the federal budget. Interest on the national debt was another 15%. Barely 30% remained to run the rest of the government, including the Postal Service, which was the largest organization outside of the military. More than one-third of the Navy's budget was for the pay and subsistence of its personnel. Less than $800,000 was estimated for provisions and repairs of vessels, and another $400,000 was for repairs and improvements of Navy yards. The budget allocated no money for new construction. The Navy Jackson inherited in 1829 was also a reflection, in part, of the man who had preceded him as president. John Quincy Adams was not only Jackson's predecessor. To Jackson and his followers, Adams was the man who had usurped the presidency itself during one of the most contentious elections in American history. The rivalry extended to how the Navy was managed. Adams, unlike Jackson, was one of the early American elites. The son of the president who had created the Department of the Navy in 1798, Adams benefited from his father's political prominence. From an early age, Adams served as his father's secretary during assignments in Europe. Adams became the minister to Holland in Washington's second administration at the youthful age of 27. He served as minister to Russia from 1809 to 1814, and the next 3 years as the minister to the court of St. James. When he returned to the United States in 1817, he was nominated for and confirmed as Secretary of State under President James Monroe. By the time he ran for president in 1824, he was one of the most well-traveled Americans. Jackson, by contrast, never visited a foreign country. That such a dichotomy of international experiences between the two successive presidents existed underscores the inherent necessity of a Navy and its usefulness. Adams recognized this from the outset of his administration, but Jackson also learned this lesson quickly. Adams had been at his father's side during the undeclared quasi-war with France, primarily fought in naval engagements throughout the Caribbean. But it was at a later engagement that had more impact. "The really important period of my life," he wrote in his diary on May 31, 1820, "began with the British attack upon our Chesapeake frigate in the summer of 1807. The USS Chesapeake, one of America's first six frigates built in the 1790s, had gotten underway under Captain James Barron. Only a few hours out of Norfolk, Virginia, her decks packed with crates of supplies, she was completely unprepared for any engagement. HMS Leopard awaited her with the understanding that several British naval deserters were aboard. Leopard emptied a broadside into Chesapeake. Barron ordered one cannon fired so that he would not have to say that he had surrendered the ship without firing a shot. The Leopard's captain impressed several seamen but rejected Barron's offer to surrender the ship, which might have escalated into an act of war. The United States eventually declared war 5 years later, while Adams served as minister to Russia. Adams found a sympathetic ear for the cause of neutral trade, even though Russia, through 1812 at least, was nominally allied with France. Sensing this, Adams managed to convince Tsar Alexander to open Russian ports to American goods. This diplomatic coup, one historian argues, illuminates the strategic importance Adams attached to ports as hubs of commercial activity. By the time Adams became Secretary of State, his views of the importance of the Navy and the nation's merchant fleet in growing the nation had matured, articulated in his first strategic document. As Secretary of State, Adams recognized the limitations of the nation's small fleet compared to the global dominance of the Royal Navy. Still, he knew the nation could either learn from, in some way influence, or exert commercial power regionally. Despite the British Empire's unchallenged role, there were considerable conflicts that involved navies. In the Mediterranean, for example, war raged between the Greeks and Ottoman Empire. A recent study of Adams' foreign policy suggests that, inspired by the democracies of ancient Greece, thrilled by the republican rhetoric of the Greek rebels, and horrified by Turkish authorities, Americans, like Adams, took the Greek cause to heart. Despite this, within a decade the Navy was helping to rebuild the Ottoman fleet under Jackson and Van Buren. Elsewhere, revolutions in South America under Simón Bolívar, José de San Martín, and Bernardo O'Higgins challenged the faltering Spanish Empire. Understanding the consequences of strategic overreach, Adams believed the young Navy could have a significant impact closer to home. It was he and Monroe agreed the destiny of the country to grow. Adams was already familiar with America's challenges to the South. Shortly after the War of 1812, Adams was the primary negotiator with Spain on establishing a secure border with the Empire's Florida Territory. With Jackson's victory over the British at the Battle of New Orleans still fresh in the minds of Americans, he was sent to the Georgia-Florida border in 1870. The radically anti-American Indian Jackson sought to settle the issue of security once and for all, thus preventing any potential Indian incursions into Georgia. While Adams played diplomat, Jackson executed two British merchants, Robert Armbrister and Alexander Arbuthnot, for allegedly collaborating with Indians. Severely criticized by Secretary of War John C. Calhoun, later to serve as Jackson's vice president during his first term, Adams defended Jackson's actions for four reasons. Jackson's army neutralized the Indian threat along the Florida border. Second, it stabilized U.S. borders. Third, it secured the U.S. against a weakening Spain, and swiftly and decisively projected American force against Seminole, Spanish, and British threats. Such actions risked much. Adams, already a seasoned diplomat, would have known the risks, but he also saw opportunity for the country. In a letter to Secretary of War John C. Calhoun, Jackson wrote of the incident, "I hope the execution of these two unprincipled villains will prove an awful example to the world and convince Britain that certain, if slow retribution awaits those unchristian wretches who by false promises delude and excite an Indian tribe to all the horrid deeds of savage war." The Spanish and British governments both expressed their concerns to the U.S. Secretary of State. Monroe was less forgiving of Jackson, informing the general that he had exceeded his orders and risked war. Privately, he admonished Jackson. Publicly, however, Monroe had to tread lightly with a man who was likely more popular than the president himself. On January 12, 1819, the House Committee on Military Affairs condemned the executions and debated a formal censure. House Speaker Clay supported censure, but in the end, Jackson's popularity and rising nationalistic fervor won out with 107 members of Congress voting against censure and 100 voting in favor of it. For Adams, the only way for the Navy to grow was to increase operations closer to home. In the near term, that meant the Florida Territory. In the longer term, it meant the Caribbean and the Spanish territories in Central and South America. The policy he articulated would be attributed to the president under whom he served. announced in 1823, the Monroe Doctrine declared that the Western Hemisphere was no longer open to European colonization, and that any interference would be met with American intervention. While bold and audacious, this policy had no practical method of being implemented. The U.S. Navy had insufficient force to conduct a blockade or engage in any squadron, much less fleet, action with the Royal Navy. In addition, it would not have the capability to project forces over water until the invasion of Mexico in 1847, when 13,000 American troops landed at Veracruz. It is also possible that, by underwriting the Monroe Doctrine, the Royal Navy blunted the U.S. Navy, reducing its need to grow to defend itself and thus slowing subsequent development until the 1880s. As president, Adams became an advocate for the Navy, proposing increases in the size of the fleet as well as the establishment of a naval academy, but most of his efforts came to naught. The same populist tide that had overwhelmingly voted for Jackson swept in a new wave of congressmen who referred to themselves not as Democratic Republicans, but formally as Jacksonians. With 4 years of a determined opposition, Adams managed to increase the size of the Navy, but was unable to accomplish much else given a hostile Congress. The same was true after the 1828 presidential election, when memories of the corrupt bargain had festered enough to grant Jackson his outright victory and claim the prize denied to him 4 years earlier. At just a few days shy of his 68th birthday, Jackson was inaugurated as the oldest president to first assume the office. His administration inherited international issues, a nation formed by differing political philosophies, and a navy shaped by several wars, and only having recently formed permanent squadrons around the globe. But if Jackson inherited issues that formed the country, then the country likewise inherited a president formed by his experiences. Both fueled each other for the next 8 years. Nowhere was this more evident than with the U.S. Navy. As Jackson took office, the country offered his administration a realized sense of democratic style of government. The American culture was on the precipice of new ways of education as well, as a moral imperative from a new religious revival movement. The American economy was only beginning its surge forward in maritime commerce that would spur wealth and development. And there was Jackson, arguably one of the most popular Americans since Washington, who was ready to assume leadership over it all. His sense, albeit often misplaced, of justice, of populist democracy, and of government accountability also began a new era for the Navy. The Navy, battle-tested by three wars, was a beneficiary of this era of activism and democratization. The mood of the country and administration encouraged and enabled the Navy to advance beyond a simple battle force of wooden hulls and iron cannons. The 1830s offered the Navy opportunities for global presence and influence. Naval officers embarked on missions that fostered a new way of thinking. The Navy was ready for a change. It was ready for an era of intellectual awakening.